Okay, thanks. Yeah, so we're quite a bit behind schedule. So
Sorry.
the main focus of my talk may be shortcuts in this talk. But anyways, the focus I intended on talking about was basically how to access quantum many-body states in two very different settings. So the first setting is on quantum computers or quantum simulators. So as you probably know, there's a lot of effort going into making these artificial quantum systems in many different platforms, like trapped ions or superconducting circuits, for example. And so we'll have more qubits, ability to carry out deeper unitary circuits. So the hope is that we can now realize some of the interesting many-body states we've all been studying for a while in these quantum systems. So the first part of the talk will be about finding protocols for realizing, in particular, non-trivial many-body states using real-time evolution or unitary operations in these platforms. And the second part will be about accessing these quantum states on classical computers or basically doing numerics. And obviously, there are a lot of classical computers lying around. And so the second part will be about playing around with a new variational wave function for many-body ground states. That's kind of motivated by this first part, but it'll involve imaginary time evolution, which so far is kind of hard to carry out on this side. Given this audience and the fact that imaginary time is just simply more fun to think about, I'll try to dedicate more time to the second half. Okay, so here are my collaborators, both real and imaginary. So here's Wenwei Ho from Harvard. He was involved in this the real-time part, and details can be found in this reference here. And the imaginary time part was done with Matt and Roger, who are both at Perimeter and University of Waterloo, as well as Tarun Grover from UCSD. And this project was driven largely by Matt, who's a PhD student in Roger's group. And details can be found here. Okay, so let's just jump into the first part. As I said, the goal will be to construct unitary circuits that take us from trivial product states that you begin with in the lab into non-trivial entangled states, so states that are not smoothly connected to product states. And our motivation was this fairly recent algorithm in the quantum information community called QAOA, or Quantum Approximate Optimization Algorithm. So the goal of these people was to find a quantum algorithm for solving a hard optimization problem, a classical optimization problem. So say you have a lot of classical bits, zeros and ones, and your goal is to find a configuration that satisfies as many constraints on those bits as possible. Well, you can encode those constraints into a Hamiltonian, and then the problem just becomes finding the classical configuration that minimizes the energy of the Hamiltonian built from these constraints. And so their approach was very different from the usual adiabatic approach for this problem. So usually, to get to the ground state of some target Hamiltonian, the adiabatic approach would tell you to just smoothly interpolate from your simple product state Hamiltonian HX into the target one. And if you do that slowly, then the ground state will also interpolate into the desired target ground state, solving your optimization problem. But for digital quantum computers, which cannot carry that deep circuits at the present, this adiabatic approach may not be so good. So what they suggested was something a little bit more extreme. They suggested starting out with this trivial product state of your simple Hamiltonian, and then now evolving in alternating fashion, first with a target Hamiltonian for some time, gamma one, then with a simple one for another time, and back and forth. And at the end of the day, you get some wave function that depends on these angles or time steps, gammas and betas, which now form basically variational parameters for this wave function. So to get as close to the target ground state as possible, you want to minimize the energy of this variational wave function with respect to the target Hamiltonian. So we'll consider a slightly more general approach that just involves some general interaction Hamiltonian for one set, as opposed to the target Hamiltonian per se. So let's see how well this works just for, again, our favorite models, transverse fieldizing. So I'm sure you all know about this, but for completeness, we work with a 1D system of qubits with nearest neighbor ferromagnetic exchange coupling and a transverse field. And so there are two phases, a ferromagnetic phase with symmetry breaking and a trivial paramagnetic phase. And there's a transition at G equals 1. So our goal will be to go from this paramagnet to the ferromagnet and the paramagnet to this critical point. Both are examples of non-trivial phases. Okay, so let's first get to the extreme ferromagnetic state, which is just the CAT state of all up plus all down. So that's our target. It's a ground state of the Hamiltonian. And the other piece we use in this QAOA approach is the transverse field. And so in this case, the interaction Hamiltonian we use will be the same as the target Hamiltonian. So we just evolve with these two in a back and forth manner and optimize these gammas and betas to get as close to the GHZ state as possible. Okay, so plotted here is a graph of the energy we can achieve with this variational wave function as a function of the number of steps we allow in this protocol. Okay, and this is shown for various different system sizes. And as you can see, there's this jump to the minimum energy minus 1, which means we've prepared perfectly that target GHZ state precisely at p equals L over 2. So this kind of makes sense because the transverse fieldizing model maps the free fermions. And so the target state is parameterized by L parameters. And right at p equals L over 2, we have precisely L variational parameters that can match the constraints in the target state. So constraint counting, it makes sense. But I should say that proving this rigorously for, you know, arbitrary system size is pretty challenging. We still have not been able to do that. Okay, so one interesting thing is we can look at the entanglement in the intermediate steps of this protocol. Okay. So so here I've taken a 12-qubit system, in which case p equals 6 is sufficient to prepare the GHZ state perfectly. And now we can look at what the intermediate states, how entangled are they. So, okay, so we begin with this trivial product state with no entanglement. And then slowly we build in entanglement until at the halfway point, it appears we have some volume law entangled state. And then it goes back down until we finally reach the target GHZ state with log 2 entanglement. So this kind of shows that, okay, well, it's kind of expected, but it shows that it's very different from the adiabatic approach, which would remain in the ground state manifold at all times. So you'd always be moving around in area law regime states. In contrast, this one kind of goes deep into Hilbert space, explores a volume law regime, and then it comes back down very carefully to the target GHZ state. So the entanglement dynamics of this are very different. Okay, so you know we can do this for other non-trivial states as well. For example, the quantum critical point at G equals 1. Our variational onslaught is the same. It involves both these pieces, exchange and field. But now we just minimize energy with respect to this target Hamiltonian with both pieces. So we find something very similar. So now I've plotted the fidelity of this variational wave function with the target wave function as a function of the number of steps in this protocol. And like the GHZ state, there's this jump at precisely p equals L over 2 to perfect fidelity. Okay, so you can really kind of run this protocol for all your favorite many-body states. For example, it also works well for Torah code in two dimensions. And I think the biggest merit of this first part is just that it's a very simple and an efficient approach for these near-term quantum platforms. So so we just generate a list of these angles for these unitaries that some experimentalists can carry out on their small quantum computer. So that's one kind of mode of operation of this, in which on our classical computer we optimize this, find these angles, feed them to an experimentalist to carry out. But there's a hybrid mode of operation that was pointed out in these original papers, Farhugelson, Gudman, Wecker, Hissing, Strohr, in which you involve both the quantum and a classical computer together. Because as you probably thought already, optimizing this wave function for bigger system sizes will get very hard eventually. So we really want to carry out the hardest part of this, which is that unitary evolution on a quantum platform itself. Okay. So the idea is that you would start out with some arbitrary guess for these optimal parameters, carry that unitary circuit out on your quantum platform, then read out the energy of this wave function with respect to the Hamiltonian, and then on a classical computer, spit out a new set of angles, basically do gradient descent or some similar thing, spit out a new set of angles, carry that out on the simulator, and then repeat this feedback loop. Okay, so this would be the eventual scheme in which you can do many-body numerics with both quantum and classical.
So the H readout is an ensemble average? So you have to
You need to do it'd be pretty challenging too. You need to prepare the state multiple times, right? So this this scheme is also rather challenging, as Mike has kind of alluded to. But maybe in the future with good enough quantum simulators, we can do this. But in the meantime, we'd like to see if there are kind of inspired approaches purely for classical computers. So the second part will be a gigantic Wick rotation with some non-trivial consequences. So the second top will be just for classical many-body numerics. Okay. So basically, this QAOA motivated a related variational ansatz. So say you're given a Hamiltonian involving two pieces, could be transistorializing or many different things like Hubbard model, for example. Motivated by this first part, we propose the following variational wave function, which consists of starting out again with some simple state psi naught that will usually be the ground state of HB in this case. It doesn't have to be. And then now we evolve in imaginary time with these two pieces, HA and HB. Okay. And we do this, we iterate this capital P numbers of times. And since it's imaginary time, now we have to normalize at the end of the day. So this variational wave function is guaranteed to capture the true ground state of H in the limit of P goes to infinity. And this is because you can look at the usual projector approach, where you just evolve with the target Hamiltonian directly in imaginary time. And if you do this long enough, namely longer than the inverse gap of H, then you'll just project out all those excited states and reach the target ground state. So as you saw in Mike's talk, you can trotterize this with ITBD, for example. And then you get a circuit precisely of this form, but now in which the alphas and betas are infinitesimal, because you've trotterized it, and now you need a very large P. Okay. But in any case, this provides a guarantee that this works given enough variational parameters. However, like before, we'll be interested in the regime of small numbers of variational parameters in which these angles are not small, but finite and variable, their parameters to be optimized. So Yeah, so this is motivated by the QAOA part in the first part, but it also carries some physical motivation directly. So for example, in the Hubbard model, where HA might be the Hubbard interaction, HB might be fermion hopping. Now in this case, if you take an extreme limit of like alpha goes to infinity, then you're just doing a Grutzler projection. If you start out in a free fermion state, the ground state of the free fermion part of the Hamiltonian. And so in the case of this Hubbard model, you can kind of interpret these pieces as doing like a soft Grutzler projection, or you're kind of weakly enforcing single occupancy. And then the other piece, you're promoting itinerancy in this back and forth manner. Okay. And so this p equals one ansatz was actually considered before by Grutzler, Beresfeld, Otsuka. And there's a recent related ansatz by Weise and Weise. So this ansatz has some physical motivation behind it.
I just have a quick question.
Yeah.
You're not splitting HB and HA up into small unitary gates.
No. So
this is kind of like still looking towards like implementing this on a quantum computer where it's not more expensive to time evolve using the whole Hamiltonian instead of like small pieces.
Well, okay, so in the back of our minds, we have, we consider HA and HB to be kind of simple pieces, right? Like pieces that you could diagonalize individually. You know exactly what's going on for each piece alone, right? So now we want to test out this ansatz on again, our favorite model, TFIM. In which we can kind of see how well it scales with system size. Yeah. So in the case of TFIM, again, we have just an exchange part and a transverse field part that we're applying back and forth in imaginary time. And we optimize these parameters now to minimize the energy. So first, we'll try targeting the critical point of the 1D TFIM model. So plotted here is the relative error in the energy of this variational wave function, again, as a function of the number of steps you allow in this algorithm for different system size. So as you can see, it does quite well, even for p equals 2, which involves a total of 4 variational parameters. You already get a pretty good relative error of 10 to the minus 4. But of course, for a critical system, the relative error in energy can be kind of misleading, right? You really want to ask how well does it capture the true ground state. So we want to look, again, at fidelity now. So plotted here is the error in the fidelity with respect to the true critical state as a function of system size now. And basically, each shaded region is the regime that a given P can access. Okay. So you can kind of roughly see that basically to get a target fidelity, for example, 10 to the minus 10, you can access a system size that's twice as big as the original one just by adding an extra layer of this ansatz. So basically, it appears that the number of variational parameters you need scales logarithmically with system size.
What's the range on G?
The range on G, you mean the parameter in the model?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, so all this is targeting the critical point.
Oh, this is all at the...
This is all targeting the critical point. Later I'll show you a little bit more general phase diagram. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's for critical DFIM.
Oh, sorry.
Okay, so This logarithmic scaling for the number of parameters is kind of the best you can do with this type of ansatz. And the way to see that is if you look at like the circuit representation of this ansatz, this is one layer, say p equals one. So you know you're evolving with 2-qubit ZZs and then single qubit Xs. And so if you look at the entanglement, the bipartite entanglement entropy of the state, this comes from cutting through this 2-qubit unitary, and you can just decompose that with SVD into this structure.
It's not unitary, right?
it's not unitary, but you can still do SVD, right? Yeah. So basically, you have two tensors, a left and a right one, and let's say you have d singular values between. Okay. Then, well, yeah, it's pretty obvious, but this picture shows that the total integument entropy you can have after p steps of this is at most p log d. Okay. So d here is the number of singular values. Okay. And so, of course, to get to the critical state, which has log L scaling of entanglement, you would need at least p scaling is log L.
What's the difference between the real and imaginary algorithm here? It looks like you could apply the same argument in most cases, right?
Yeah, this is just a lower bound on the number of steps you need. But actually, in the case of, I'll get to this soon, but in the case of real time, there are stricter bounds like Lie-Bronson. Right, so there, that'll require at least linear scaling with system size for the critical point. But yeah. Okay, so we can also compare directly with the projector method. So again, the projector method would involve evolving directly with the critical Hamiltonian for some imaginary time. And to get a target fidelity, you would need the total imaginary time to scale linearly with system size. Because of the inverse gap, the gap closes as 1 over L. Okay. So we can also look at the total imaginary time in this ansatz, which is essentially the sum of all these imaginary time steps. And so motivated by this log L scaling in the number of variational parameters, we propose a scaling form that's tau log L. Yeah, basically the scaling form is a function of tau log L to some power. And as you can see, it all collapses nicely for a range of system sizes. And we get a very different scaling that to get a target fidelity, you only need imaginary time scaling as log L to some power, in this case, 2.3. So it's a pretty dramatic speed up relative to the projector method.
L is the total number of spins?
Yes.
Okay, because for him, it was the it was an L by L lattice.
Yeah, this is all 1D so far.
Okay.
Just to start testing. Yeah. Okay, so again, we don't have a complete understanding of why this works well, but we do have some pieces of the puzzle. Just kind of like why this ansatz might be pretty powerful. So let me just remind you of some basics of imaginary time physics. They're very basic facts. It's just usually we don't think about these things. So first, there's no Lie-Bronson bound in this case. Imaginary time is effectively very non-local. Okay, and in particular, you can actually prepare the GHZ state from the product state in constant imaginary time that does not scale with system size. And this is because the imaginary time evolution, all it cares about is a gap of HZZ. It doesn't really see different phases of matter. It doesn't care about that. Again, because it's effectively non-local. And because of that non-locality, you can end up with very strange things. Like local operators can actually generate entanglement very far away from the action of that operator. So here's a very simple example. Say you have two qubits that are entangled, but not maximally entangled. Well, to increase the entanglement between these two, with unitary evolution, you would need to act on both with some two-qubit gate, right? However, for imaginary time evolution, even acting on a single qubit, you can change the entanglement of the state across this cut. And so in one extreme example, you just make a measurement. That would be the extreme case of just a projective measurement. In that case, you disentangle this completely. But you can also increase the entanglement with this process by just reweighting these two parts of the linear combination. Okay. So this example shows you that the more the initial entanglement of the state, the more imaginary time evolution can change this entanglement. So there's some kind of like catalytic element involved here. So So based on this, it seems that in principle, you can actually have an exponential growth of this bipartite entanglement entropy up to a certain point. And this is actually what we see in this imaginary time ansatz targeting this TFIM critical point. So plotted here is the bipartite entanglement entropy for a half cut as a function of the imaginary time used in this protocol, again, for some different system size. And this is a log linear plot. So as you can see, the entanglement entropy does increase exponentially up to the point at which you reach the target state. Okay, so as another illustration of the lack of Lee-Robinson bound for imaginary time, we also looked at the mutual information between two spins separated by some distance delta x for the intermediate states of this protocol. So it appears that all the intermediate states have this power law tail in the mutual information, which indicates that already there are long-range correlations being built in by this imaginary time evolution. Okay, so that was the story for TFIM. We optimized everything using obviously the free fermion representation, but unfortunately, life is more than free fermions. Of course, maybe that's a good thing. Actually. In general, we need more powerful techniques to optimize this ansatz. Like Monte Carlo. So what I'll show you now is results from not using the free fermion approach here, but just using Monte Carlo sampling to estimate this energy cost function for the ansatz. So what we do is quite simple. We just basically use the usual quantum classical mapping from 1D TFIM to 2D classical Ising. But then now all the expectation value of operators for ansatz can be mapped to expectation value of classical operators in some dual classical stat-mech model in one higher dimension. So now we're just sampling classical configurations to get an estimate of this observable. So in this way, we can estimate the energy of this wave function using Monte Carlo. So here, here I've plotted the relative error in the energy achieved by the ansatz. Now, as a function of the transverse field, so before we were focusing on this critical point at g equals 1, and the dots and rhombi here are basically the results obtained by Monte Carlo sampling the energy, and the solid line here is the result from basically the pretty much exact free fermion optimization. Okay, so yeah, the short story is that Monte Carlo does a pretty good job. We can't go to as large p as before because the sampling approach is harder than the free fermion. But with p equals 1 and p equals 2, you can already again get very good, very low relative error in energy. And what this plot also kind of shows is, again, the fact that imaginary time evolution does not really care about the different phases that much. So basically, you know, you were starting out deep in the paramagnetic phase. So you might expect that it's harder to go across to the ferromagnetic side. That would be the case for real-time evolution. And indeed, it's a little bit harder, but it doesn't seem to be like a major obstacle here. Okay, so now I'm sure there are haters in the audience for TFIM, the skeptics of integrability playing secret roles in all this. So we also took care to investigate just a small generalization of adding a longitudinal field to this model to make it non-integrable. Now that we're doing Monte Carlo sampling anyways, we don't need to rely on the free fermion representation of the Bayer model. So now we want to target ground states of this non-integrable model. And to do that, we also need to modify our onsets accordingly. So now we replace the piece involving evolution by the exchange with we just add a piece that's evolving with this longitudinal field, and we add an additional variational parameter associated with that. So it's a simple generalization. So plotted here is the relative error in energy as a function of now this longitudinal field with g fixed at 1. Okay. So this is just a proof of principle that for non-negligible models, it can also work quite well. This is just for p equals 1. Okay, so so in general, we will need Monte Carlo sampling to optimize the sansads. But then you might wonder, if we're going to use Monte Carlo sampling anyways, and assume there's no sign problem, then why not just use the projector Monte Carlo directly to reach your ground state? These are all fine techniques. They work very well, right? And indeed, for sign-free models, it is kind of hard to find an advantage using the sansads. Okay, but the interesting case is for models with sign problems. Okay, so usually usually we're just forced to stop completely. Usually, if there's a sign problem in this model, but the goal is that since I've shown you that this ansatz is very efficient, the amount of imaginary time you need is shortened substantially. It's heavily compressed. Maybe in this case, the sampling with a sign problem can be made more tractable for a given system size, right? Because the sign problem, it scales exponentially with both spatial dimensions and the imaginary time direction. So if you can kind of shorten one direction a lot, maybe we can still do some sampling even with the sign problem. Yeah. So that's a hope that we're eventually going to test out with the sansads. So the hope is that we can change the nature of the sign into something more benign. Okay. So we're pretty much on schedule. Let me just close with just a summary of this talk. So in the first part, I presented protocols for realizing non-trivial quantum states, such as TFIM quantum critical point, on quantum computers. And again, the merit is just it's a very practical approach. And we're currently collaborating with Chris Monroe's trapped ion group to realize these critical states and generalizations like thermofield double states on their trapped ion quantum computer. And in the second part, I told you about this new variational imaginary time ansatz that was motivated by the efficiency of its real-time counterpart. And basically, it requires surprisingly few parameters, surprisingly low imaginary time to describe a non-trivial state. And so our goal is to eventually apply it to harder models, ones with sign problem, and we'll see if they can really mitigated. So that's all I wanted to say. Thanks.
In the real-time case, what's your intuition for, like, if it goes to something volume law, there's a little bit of interaction with an environment and noise? Is it extremely, like,
that's
susceptible?
It probably is pretty sensitive to noise. So we did test out kind of random rotations around the optimal angles. And the scaling of the system size will not be that good. So you do need pretty precise closed evolution.
How chaotic is
right.
Trajectories.
Yeah, I imagine it would be very sensitive to perturbation.
Can you say something about the energy, the search landscape of your parameters?
Yeah, so I think Matt looked at, I'm assuming you're talking about the imaginary time.
Also in the real time, I mean, is there a difference in the free fermion case about the nature of the energy landscape to the more general case?
The more, the, wait, sorry.
Finding the ultima for your variational ansatz, I mean, that's a part of the problem, and there can be substantial number of steps required to find the optimum.
Yeah, yeah. So I think in general, we found that for like p equals one, the landscape is pretty smooth and easy to optimize, but this can get very complicated fast. That's true. So yeah, indeed a worry is that the sign problem may show up in the complexity of this landscape for the harder models, but we don't know.
I think we looked at the 1D case, like reproducing your results, and then the optimization for the 1D case would work quite well. But in the 2D case, it actually turned out that the landscape was like much harder, at least.
The 2D transistorizing model.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
On a similar number of qubits.
This is with p equals 1, or?
No, it's several p. Like we check for several p.
Oh, you check for several p. Okay. Oh, okay. Yeah, we should talk after that. Mm-hmm.
For the real case, for the gap to actually close, you need L to be very large. So, is there a problem in scalability of this? Since it's linear depth.
Yeah. It's still challenging for a quantum computer. I agree, but the linear scaling is the best you can do from the Lise-Lee-Robinson band, right? Because you need to produce that power law correlation in the critical state. That's a fundamental limitation. But so I guess indeed the first part is shortcut in the sense of relative to the adiabatic for a digital quantum computer. In terms of the scaling, we don't really have an improvement. It would always be linear with L. But this one really is a shortcut. Yeah.
Is there any regime for the imaginary time case where that normalization makes the problem intractable, like if the dimension of the Hilbert space is too large, that it takes too long to normalize it?
I don't think so. That might be only relevant for reaching like the extreme GHZ state, maybe. We didn't have any problems with normalization.
In the imaginary time case, there wasn't like an initial huge entanglement growth, right? It was just monotonic being reduced to the
imaginary time.
Yes, the imaginary time.
No, it was an exponential growth. It was a log linear.
Right? It wasn't like a peak.
That's right, yeah.
So did you consider using potential candidates instead of Monte Carlo?
We have considered a tensor network approach to optimize this. But there, I'm not sure it would provide any advantage over more conventional tensor network methods.
Yeah. Is that because the number of iterations might be quite large that you need to do to optimize the parameters?
Yeah, so I mean, you know.
I guess this is related to the complexity of the anti-landscape.
In the tensor network case, you need a number of variational parameters scaling exponentially with the depth p, right? That'll be like the bond dimension you're using in the tensor network approach, right?
I don't know if it needs to scale necessarily exponentially with the depth if it's imaginary. You might be able to in some case try a lot after each iteration, after each length. If it's for example just preparing a crystallizing state, we know that the entanglements you can get a good approximation to the final state with a reasonable bond.
That's right. But this is not like the conventional, you know, DMRG optimization, right? Like you have this layer that just representing that requires, you know, like 2 to the p bond dimension, right? And then you have to optimize that. Right? So you know from the general tensor network, it looks like you have many parameters, but it's just, you know, the structure of this ansatz, in the structure of the ansatz, it requires few parameters.
Okay,
yeah, okay, yeah.
Are there any further questions? If not, then thanks again.